Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I've been on the road for a few weeks. Went to the United Kingdom and Cornwall, which is in the United Kingdom, and then stopped in New York on the way back. Went to the Horizons Conference, which was a gathering of people interested in psychedelics, and it was interesting. Too many doctors, and doctors do fascinating studies, but they're not always the most interesting speakers, and they don't always reflect on the larger implications of their work too well, because that's not really their job. And so once again, I experienced this strange sort of almost a cognitive dissonance, where you have all these people who are drawn to these extraordinary and sometimes bizarre chemicals and experiences, eagerly packing a room, you know, that looks like it's ready for some kind of you know, freak out concert or you know, heavy talk by some bearded guru, and then you have a bunch of professionals get on stage and present their PowerPoints about their studies and protocols. And it's a strange moment. It's kind of cool in a way. There's sort of a mad science aspect of the whole thing. But once again, it set me thinking on the need for a more robust, diverse, playful, creative, and critical kind of psychedelic discourse. And which is one way of setting up today's conversation. Last night, I had been planning to talk to the philosopher Tim Morton today, but at the last moment, he remembered that he would be teaching a class during this slot. And so I was left hanging and immediately had to think of somebody who was capable of being spontaneous on the moment. Who popped into my mind, as well as the mind of my wife, who was sharing the work with me, but our friend Michelangelo. And Michelangelo's local San Francisco character, who I met at the Ayahuasca Monologues, which was an event originally started in New York City, and then took on a San Francisco guise some time ago, in which Michelangelo and I were both presenting tales of ayahuasca experience, and I found his most sprightly and entertaining. The guy has a gift of gab, but it turns out that in addition to being a storyteller, he's also a painter, a musician, a writer. And on his website, he describes himself in part as a wait, hold on a second here. My machine is work. There we go. As a shape shifting, what does it look like? Oh, and an entheogenesis. My website just crashed. So we're gonna have to go on for that. What do you describe yourself as, Michelangelo?
I think the description you're looking for is an astroverted entheogentleman.
There we go. That sounds about right. So anyway, I call him up, and luckily he's was willing to pop on over. And it's kind of silly because I'm sitting in my office, and in my wife's office 10 feet away. Michelangelo is sort of pretending to be my wife as far as Skype is concerned, but will otherwise be impersonating himself as we plunge into the realm of multimedia magic and the ambiance of entheogens and other voids and their myriad of denizens. Well, you know, I thought I'd start out. You just got back from Symbiosis, and I gave my little potted impression of the Horizons Conference. You know, where the parties were probably more fun than the stage speeches. I'm sure Symbiosis was a very different kettle of fish. But since I wasn't able to go and have gone to earlier events, I'd love just to hear your impressions. How was the event? And what is the event like for folks who don't know? What kind of significance does it have for you in terms of being an interesting festival or kind of cultural event.
Yeah, so Symbiosis, for those who don't know, it's a what here on the West Coast is known as a transformational festival, which basically means it's a bunch of people renting out some sacred land and building a bunch of quite impressive structures on there that function as stages and art installations. And then it's a kind of a conglomeration of art and music and performance, all under the envelope of the sort of a neo-tribal pseudo-shamanic chicanery that that takes place in these places. I was actually brought out there to be part of this sort of satirical theatrical production. It was called the $40,000 Pyramid Family Feud, which was based on the game show, The Family Feud, but then kind of taken to ridiculous realms. And I was brought on board as the oracle, because there always needs to be an oracle on stage. So I would bring up some offbeat observations whenever the spotlight would be brought onto me. But aside from doing the satirical thing, I also got to go on the stage that this guy Shrine had built. Shrine is known to make these amazing, aesthetically pleasing structures out of recycled materials. And this stage I got to go on just to do some storytelling. And right across from me, there were these big stages with this very loud, booming electronic music that's very hard to block out. So standing there under these recycled cans that are kind of clanging together and giving voice to the otherwise voiceless wind, I realized that where I was standing was kind of the stage that was there to embody the dying arts, actually the place where the dying arts get to revive the dead in a way. So
what do you mean by the dying arts?
Storytelling, basically anything that isn't amplified when it comes to like poetry, storytelling, acoustic music, all these kinds of things. It seems especially in these kind of the neo-tribal scenes, all this stuff has to compete with some very loud sound systems. So I call it the dying arts. It could also be called the repressed arts in that sense. Whereas, you know, some time ago, maybe these things were the central focus where the main transmission is coming through a human vessel. Now, all of a sudden, everything is kind of pre-programmed and whoever has the loudest sound system wins. So I decided to kind of just riff off of that while I was up on that stage.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, it's an interesting paradox because you know the scene is called you know neo-tribal for a reason, in the sense that a lot of the people who are drawn to these festivals or are drawn to elements of that lifestyle are sometimes quite explicitly seeking a kind of older way of relating to one another, of creating art, of creating meaning, of creating community. And it's quite vibrant. And whatever you think about the results, the urge, the desire is there and is powerful. And yet, as you point out, there's a way in which even the festivals themselves don't necessarily support spaces for the kinds of gathering, the kinds of mingling and being together that can happen in those environments. I mean, I hesitate to say this, but sometimes it makes me nostalgic for the good old hippie drum circle, because for all of its flailing limbs, the good old hippie drum circle did have a kind of acoustic collectivity that was made it very, very immediate, you know, as a kind of model for being together, for creating a culture together in an improvised way that was, you know, collective, but also very much in a particular location. And I noted for myself that one of the peaks of I went to Lightning in a Bottle earlier this year, another California festival with a pretty, you know, stellar sort of reputation. And probably my favorite bit was staying up all night around, well, a hippie drum circle. And you know, we were far enough away from the major sound systems that it could create that kind of space. But it's more, isn't it, than just the, you know, amplification and you know, the sort of electromagnetic intensification of things. It also has to do with a certain kind of conviviality, and particularly around the topic of storytelling, which I've been thinking about a lot recently, because in a way there's been a resurgence of storytelling, but in other ways it's sort of difficult to figure out exactly where to put this desire for stories. And I know this is something that's dear to your heart. So how do you think about storytelling live in front of people, or the role that stories could and or even should be playing in people's lives?
Well, I think stories and language in general have always had language is at once a perceptual tool and a communicative tool. So by communicating, you're actually able to shape and enforce perceptions of reality. So for me, language is kind of a magical medium. I mean, of course, there's magical connotations to it, like grammar is like glamour, and, you know, you get magic spellings instead of magic spells. But for me, it is kind of like spellbinding. It's kind of holding that attention, listening to the audience, listening during the spaces and the tensions, and knowing when to pick up again. And really casting that bubble and taking people on a journey through your own perceptual experiences, and then hopefully having them come out on the other side transformed, having them lose themselves a little bit and then finding themselves slightly reconfigured. During this, while I was up on that stage there, actually just another little reflection on the idea of symbiosis, literally, and the festival, is that I was there a couple of years ago, and there was this woman going around, and she was collecting a sort of a survey. She was asking everybody, how do you turn off your inner critic? And the thing that came to mind for me immediately was, you show it something indisputably good. And then I had to follow up with something inane and say, but how do you turn off your inner cricket? Later on that night, I wandered around the festival, and I stood by the water side when I heard all of a sudden this web of white noise that was woven by the crickets. Now, these festivals with their, you know, the blaring music and the stomping around and all this stuff, it's very much a human trip. There's even a festival called Enchanted Forest, but I don't think the creatures really come out for that one. They probably burrow deeper into the ground or up into the trees. Now, at this moment, when I heard this tapestry of white noise of cricket choirs, while at the same time hearing all these disparate stages blasting their what seemed like atom-splitting emulations, I started listening to how the crickets were able to create these different frequencies and pitch shifts that were somehow weaving all these disparate stages and disparate sounds into a unity. And I was like, I thought to myself, never turn off the inner cricket, because this is indisputably good, just seeing how nature was weaving together everything. And I think that those are kind of the treasures in those kind of circumstances. Just like you're saying, you're kind of longing for that archaic sense of like the communion around the drum circle, or the hearing a story told instead of all this sensory overload. I think it's maybe it just makes it more rewarding when we look for that signal in the noise, and when we find it, we realize, oh yeah, it's almost like we've set up this labyrinth, and then we have to find the core of it.
No, beautifully said, beautifully said. I'm also sort of thinking about continuing to reflect on language, particularly in these very experiential scenes, you know, entering into a festival environment, you're invited to sort of into a kind of wordless rhapsody of dance, of immersion in music, and, you know, whether or not people are, you know, taking visionary plants or whatever, there's a kind of internal phantasmagoria where you just ride through these spaces that are, you know, notoriously ineffable. You know, if you can describe them, you weren't there. There's in some ways, in many ways, actually, a bit of a distrust of language, or even a resistance to it, among, you know, a lot of people who are drawn to meditation and yoga and trance dancing and ayahuasca circles, et cetera, because it's seen as kind of a grubby, all too human, all too tricky sort of distraction, almost, from these kinds of more direct experiences. This is not necessarily my view, although I have a, you know, kind of complicated take on it. For me, actually, the wordless experiences you know, part of the what makes them so marvelous is their the demand they make on some of us anyway to try to, you know, get step up our game in terms of languaging our experiences or evoking them or playing with the kind of inspiration of these wordless encounters in language. And I know that that's something, if you think about someone like Terence McKenna, I mean, part of what made Terence so wonderful was just that he was willing to sort of port some of these energies, these evocative, magical interconnections that are often more implicit than explicit. He was willing to port those into language and to bring this kind of storytelling, evocative, almost an oral tradition out of these experiences. And you know, and it's no accident that his voice is more important to his legacy than his writings. So there, you know, he represented, I think, a really interesting space that he was operating in, the archaic revival, a phrase that he kind of came up with and was very early to insist on, that the rave culture that he saw emerging in the late 80s and early 90s was part of an archaic revival that was simultaneously moving forward into the technological future and in some sense recovering or recuperating or reinvoking an earlier way of being. And in a way, he manifested that in his own media, which was less about books and TV shows and movies and more about his voice, albeit an amplified and recorded voice. These things are important to you as well, and I'd love to hear a little bit about how you bring your language into these experiences, how you see these experiences inspiring your language, whether it's your storytelling or your lyrics or just indeed the way that you articulate in day-to-day life, which I know you bring a lot of humor and playfulness too. So how do these sort of wordless or notoriously ineffable experiences motivate language in your case?
I think that's a really good point. I very much agree with your perspective on it too, about stepping up your game in the face of the unspeakable. For myself, I've kind of coined this phrase of self-transmedia, which to me, you know, the old saying, chase many rabbits, catch none. Which for me, that's something that's come up a lot because I pursue a bunch of different disciplines. And for me, the sense is that, sure, maybe by the end of the day, you don't end up with rabbit stew, but imagine all the things you'd learn about rabbits and about the habits of rabbits and about yourself in relation to that. So for me, it's the self is the ultimate medium, and that extends itself into image, sound, or word, or wherever that may go. Now, going into these kind of wordless realms, for me, the art of storytelling or the art of language, it reaches for the unspeakable. And the same thing with visual arts, for me, it reaches towards an expression of the invisible. So to me, that is a self-transcendent media. So definitely going into these unspeakable spaces, sure, you might not be able to speak them. A lot of people will say, like, oh, no, words can't touch that. Well, still try and see what happens. Once you push your language to the edge, or maybe even over the edge, see if it sprouts wings. See what it does of its own accord. Saul Williams is an incredible poet. He was actually there at Symbiosis. And he has this amazing way of just flooding you with this barrage of words that to me had this effect of the 5-point palm exploding heart technique from Kill Bill, where you're touched on 5 different points, take a few steps and your heart explodes. It was kind of like that. I get this barrage that just the right key words touch me in just the right places and unlock something in me through which my defenses come down entirely, and then the waterworks just start running. So I feel like these places can be touched upon. Of course, they can't be literally transcribed or literally described, but I feel like we can push ourselves further in order to at least touch onto these human spaces that are present in all of us. So yeah, even if we can't describe them, we can at least bring the attention to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another thing that we sometimes miss out on for good reasons, for understandable reasons, I should say, is the factor of inspiration, which you just kind of mentioned. I mean, it's a wonderful word because it goes to the same root of spirit, of breath. So it's so clearly bound up with our language. And the idea of inspiration, you know, traditionally in traditional cultures, you know, the storyteller was never speaking strictly from memorized points. They would remix elements that were received from other storytellers or from earlier versions of the tale. And then there was also an element of inspiration. And many bards and many oracles were about the language that happens in that moment. And indeed, in my experience, that the language that happens when you are over the edge, when you're not in control, when it sometimes takes flight, sometimes it doesn't, but when it does take flight, that's a blessing. That's something that is a kind of emerging, not just from you or even your language, which isn't really you, you know, it's something else that sort of ghosts yourself. But it's even more, it's almost from the wellspring of language as such, or the wellspring of the combinatory possibilities of language. The fact that they can, the forms of recombination are infinite. And I know in my speaking, when I talk, I never just read, and sometimes, not always, but sometimes I find the most interesting parts are things that I had never said before and that emerge from wherever they emerge. And it's a wonderful kind of mode. And there's something about that that I think that most people don't feel that they're authorized to do. Like, language for them is a form of communication or a form of information, you know, exchange. But they don't necessarily feel, well, I'm not a poet, I'm not a writer, I'm not someone who can allow inspiration to happen. And so when you get, you know, it's particularly, I'm thinking of how people talk about their ineffable experiences, whether they're yoga or meditation or an ayahuasca session. And they're, you know, there's often a kind of, it's as if people are already limiting themselves rather than going, that experience was so marvelous, I'm going to try to bring some of that energy into the inspiration of my own speech now. And so when people do that with a Saul Williams, or I mean, when I've heard you speak and you're going for it, it's a wonderful thing just to be in the presence of that kind of not just the creativity of language itself, but the willingness to risk failure in order to really let the wings take off.
Yeah. I think a lot of people will put their language on a leash, and I think language has largely become a domesticated animal. Like, we literally will talk shit, you know, or we'll use language to mark our territories, which is literally what you do when you walk an animal on a leash, you know, you let it take a piss somewhere to mark its territory. But I think language is kind of a symbiotic animal or entity that coexists with humanity. And when you take it off the leash and you allow it to communicate you, a different thing starts happening. And for me, a lot of my expression has been about allowing the channel to get ahead of its meaning. Like you're saying, when you're just kind of like letting it go and trusting what's going to come through. And then later on, you can interpret it. It's almost like you start hearing yourself speaking. And once you start listening to yourself and interpreting what's there, you learn things you didn't even know you knew. And that's something that's very interesting to me. And psychedelics have definitely helped me in that apprehension, in that sense of opening up the channel. If I may tell a short story of how this kind of came about for me during an LSD experience some time ago.
Please do.
About 12, 13 years ago. I was living I'm from the Netherlands, by the way. So I was living back in Amsterdam in an anti-squat because there's a big squatter problem in Amsterdam. So I was put into an old dentist practice in order to keep the actual squatters out. So I was like a legal squatter. And over time, I turned this dentist practice into a transcendentist practice as I was gradually unfolding my own wings, my own potential. And one night I took, after much research into these different spiritual disciplines and wandering through the mazes of Amsterdam, feeling like the city was a maze and humanity was lost. And we were all just, at night, I would see people searching for something, like we were searching for a way out. And then you'd find these people like Hare Krishnas or other religious folks that would just ramble on as if they had found a way out of the maze, while really they were just caught in some meta maze. I found myself doing all this research and reading the Tao Te Ching and listening to the Hare Krishna speak and reading a lot of Alan Watts and all sorts of other stuff that kind of created a map for myself, because I wanted to familiarize myself with the thing that beat my heart, because I was very much up in my head and was terrified of the biological, spiritual reality of my existence. So in order to test the integrity of these structures that I had built up in my head, I decided to take a hit of LSD in a controlled setting. At some point in there, I was looking at my girlfriend. We were sitting opposite each other, and the whole room darkened except for her eyes. There were these like paisley floods of fern-like patterns that were building on her face, except the eyes. And then she laughed, and the whole thing retreated, almost like anemone or something, just like in the sea breeze sway, just retracted. And I said, "Don't laugh," because that scared it away. And she said, "If it tickles, I laugh," which to me was perfect logic. So we settled back into the trance, and these ferns and these paisley start building again. And then all of a sudden, snap, I'm looking at a different face. Now she's looking like a little Buddha with tweaking eyelashes and dangling earlobes. And I blink my eyes, and now I'm looking at a blue face, and I'm looking at Krishna. And I blink my eyes again, and now my girlfriend had a big, compassionate beard, and she had become fully embodied Jesus Christ. And of course, the only utterance you can have in a moment like that is, "Jesus Christ." I pulled away and found myself swirling through this serpentine flesh pool of associations of demons and angels and deities all swirling around me. And as my mind was boggling and trying to reach for some kind of, not even an answer, I was reaching for the question, like, why? Why did I just see these faces instead of the face that's supposed to be there? The answer that arose was that this was the only language that I had for these things, because I'd been studying these various schools of thought, and these were the closest thing to representing the sense of universal love that I was feeling in that moment. As soon as that realization came, the dissociative whirlpool pulled away, and I found myself back in the room, but now the room was filled with these colorful strands of tangible energy. And this energy seemed like it was ancient. It had been there from the unborn beginning, and it would be there till the undying end. And I said to myself, "Oh, this creative energy that's always been here. Yeah, I'd call that God." And I'd let that inside of me in that moment. I opened up. And as soon as it rushed into me, I felt so inspired that I picked up a paintbrush, three colors, and a panel, and I started just putting the paint down on it, swirling it. And then came the doubt. A question came to my head: what are you creating? And instantly this wave came over me that washed away any doubt, and it just said, "Trust." And I kept going without knowing what I was painting. And by the end of it, I was looking at the finished painting, and it was a perfect representation of what I'd gone through. It was this sort of perfect, almost Krishna-like self that was staring into this abyss, this sort of like yin-yang, swirling, unified duality space. And on the side, there was this image of this nauseated ego with this jackal cast between them, keeping it at bay. And it was just a perfect representation of what I had gone through without thinking about it. This was just the channel getting ahead of its meaning and then afterwards reflecting what I had experienced. That's the true meaning of the word psychedelic, you know, mind manifesting, which is why I'm intrigued by sort of practical hallucinations of using a hallucinatory state, not necessarily induced by any kind of substance, more in the sense, as you had mentioned it in your book, Nomad Codes, of rather wanting to think drugs than do drugs, or as Salvador Dali said, "I am drugs, I don't do drugs, I am drugs," of emulating that state where reality becomes more like a crystal ball than a concrete wall, where it becomes a springboard into some higher realm rather than an obstruction of our perception of reality.
Yeah, and how much in that whole, that was wonderful tale, and I think tells me a lot also about you and your method and your expression. But how much expression is part of the loop? And I think that's part of the story too, is that I think a lot of people, They have extraordinary experiences, and they're not really sure what to do with them. And because of that, they often, maybe this is a little harsh, but they often sort of put them into the categories that have already been prepared for them by other people, by society. So you go, you have your yoga experience, then you say, oh, it's because I'm this, or now I'm a Hindu, or it's the chakras, or whatever the story that you have is. And one of the ways to sort of, you know, redirect that process is to make expression, even just for yourself, part of the process, whether it's writing it or drawing it. I saw a wonderful presentation in Breaking Convention, not this year, but 2 years ago, 3 years ago, by a Ayahuascaro who was from South America, but I had been educated, I think, in a Western university or whatever, but he was very well spoken and articulate and in command of the language. And he had a group that he worked with, I believe it was in Switzerland. And it was very interesting, kind of nouveau ayahuasca circle, where there were traditional elements in Icaros and such, but there was also very much a more kind of European sense of Euro-American sense of psychology, of depth psychology, of arts therapy, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things they did was that everyone did it painted something the morning after, rather than telling you the ubiquitous tale. And what he did was really, you know, so you go, okay, that's kind of cute, great, you know, good for the folks. But he actually went through, and most of his talk was really showing people's visions, and particularly how they changed over time. So as people got more and more familiar with the act of expression through their watercolors mostly, there was almost like a little feedback loop that started to happen, and both their experiences and the pieces of art became more robust and began to reflect on themselves. And so it really became part of the path of that, you know, thing everybody talks about, integration, which doesn't always seem to me to be actually so well played out. And so I really hear your story not only as a good perception of how the psychedelic part of psychedelics operate, the mind manifesting, the set and setting, the stories you've been programmed with emerging in the midst of something that's always larger than any particular meaning, is that to intervene in that process, again, with or without compounds — this is not at all just about drugs — but to really intervene in that process, you got to bring your own expression and your own risks of expression into that loop, because otherwise you just kind of get stuck in the same stories and templates that are already prepared for you.
Yeah, I think that's a great attitude that this guy has, to have people draw their visions, because it gives them a language and, again, a communicative tool and a perceptual tool to, like you're saying, loop back into the experience the next ceremony around and actually use the language that they've learned in order to apprehend their experience beyond words. Which to me is what that is, you know, like visual language or sonic languages. These are all different ways, mnemonic devices to bring something back from the dream state.
Absolutely. Well, we'll explore some more of those devices in a moment, because we got to take a break now. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network, and we're talking to Michelangelo about art, poetry, expression, and the ever-present edge. Be right back.
It's not liberal, it's not conservative, it's progressive, the truth that empowers, right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Baker. Join me Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for the Lifeboat Hour. Formerly hosted by the late Michael Rupert, the Lifeboat Hour, now hosted by me, focuses on creating internal and external resilience to fortify us in turbulent times. Our guests, music, and call-ins make for a show that you will want to keep on your calendar and share with your friends. For the finest in resilience radio, join us at the Lifeboat Hour on Sunday nights at 9 Eastern.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm your host, Eric Davis. We're talking to Michelangelo about forms of expression. I want to also mention that you live in a really interesting situation, especially given how San Francisco has been changing these days. So rather than try to give it my own spin, could you just tell me a little bit about the convent?
Sure. Yeah, I live in one of San Francisco's last remaining artist collectives, and this is a former convent that has turned into an artist collective that houses 24 people of various creative disciplines. We've got writers, painters, dancers, stand-up comedians, video editors, filmmakers, you name it, we got it. And the space is an old convent. We have an actual chapel as kind of the heart of the space, in which we do various events. Sometimes there's a singing circle, which is a sort of, I call it cathartic wailing, happens in there. So people come in there and they kind of get to give a wordless expression of what they're going through in order to get to some kind of a cathartic state that our resident sound healer facilitates weekly. There's also, there have been comedy nights in there, musical nights. I've hosted a figure drawing sessions and also a dream embodiment workshop at some point, which was very cool. And then we've got workspaces in the basement. We've got a rooftop with a mural garden and all that sort of stuff. And then, of course, kitchens and individual spaces, individual rooms. And it's a very interesting living experiment, I'd say. Especially
yeah,
since it's the last contained bit of San Franciscan bohemia. It's almost like we're living in a little time capsule.
Yeah, and it's wonderfully inspiring to visit, both in, just in terms of the that vibe of, like, you know, the kind of you're not really sure where to locate it. Is this a gathering of spiritual mendicants? Is it a dorm room? Is it a hacker space? Is it some kind of new community? But, you know, communities in general, however they're structured, there's all sorts of different ways to structure them, tend to have some kind of they need some kind of consistency, not necessarily a shared ideology, but a shared commitment or something. What is it that makes the convent work? Like, what are the elements that seem to work for such a wide range of people, particularly trying to live in a very expensive and somewhat stressful urban environment?
Well, I think San Francisco itself, veiled in the nebulous fog, kind of shrouds you from the rest of the world. And in effect, the convent is its kind of like mini bubble that almost shrouds you from the rest of San Francisco. So it becomes this very privileged little bubble that is its own self-contained universe with various entities washing upon the shore and getting carried away again. So there's a lot of movement in there, but the common denominator seems to be some kind of creative harmony. I mean, sure, there's, you know, the actual policies and upkeep. That's always a challenge. Sometimes it's like living in Lord of the Fruit Flies or Bohemian Rat City. But for the most part, it's the creative harmony that keeps it together. And people collaborate with each other. It's a great networking tool, too. And for somebody like me who, you know, I consider myself an astrovert because I'm always geared up towards some kind of astral dimension with my attention, but I'm also an introvert and also an extrovert all at once. And this kind of social setting is great for me too. When I emerge from my my recluse habits, I can just immediately wander into some kind of a social ambiance, so I don't need to go outside to look for that. So it really is its own self-contained universe.
And what was the practice you talk about and you were doing in the chapel? Some dream channeling? What was?
Yeah, so this was, I called it Dream Theater, which is about as ungoogleable as my name. I am the ungoogleable Michelangelo, of course. It's It's Renaissance Men and Ninja Turtles all the way down, Sonny. The Dream Theater, the way I spelled it, was with R-E to distinguish it from the prog rock band of the 80s. And this was a dream embodiment workshop. So people would come in and they would share their dreams. They would just tell us about dreams that they had while in a sleeping state, those kinds of dreams. And I would very quickly curate all the different facets of the dream using whatever and whoever we had around. And then we would basically act out that dream. I'd kind of stage it and we would play it out in real space while lubricated by a lubricating the lucidity with a live musical accompaniment. I described the Dream Theater as an immersive theatrical experience without an audience, scripted by transmissions from the subconscious. And what this would do in effect is, for instance, I'll give you an example of a very simple dream. This girl had dreamt that she was swimming in the ocean, and then suddenly a whale came up below her and lifted her to the surface, and then another whale breached the surface and started dancing in front of her. So I very quickly, I had maybe like 15, 20 people in the room, so I said, seven of you guys, you are now waves. So through a unification of sound and movement, they became this sort of sort of like ocean wavy thing, you know? Seems very, you know, like almost like the little kids in the school play dressed like sunflowers or something, right? But bear with me. Then the girl basically was swimming, so I had another like five people lift her and kind of swim her through the air. Then another person came up below her as a whale, so she was now riding this whale. And then another person would breach the waves as a whale, right? It seems all very simple because there's no costumes, there's no anything like that. But through this unification of the sound and the movements and through this emulation, they would actually enter into the embodiment of the dream state, separate from any kind of interpretation, and just really like step into that space. And the most beautiful thing was that afterwards, when you'd reflect on it, people would be talking about this dream as though it was their own. And listening to other people's dreams can be very, well, not even boring, but it's just, it's very difficult to keep up with it because it goes all over the place. There's no real logic, waking life logic to it. But once you play it out in such a way, it becomes easier to grasp. And then hearing people talk about somebody else's dreams as if it were their own, that's as good of a boundary dissoluting experience as any I've had. And it takes that old quote by Joseph Conrad, "We live as we dream alone," and just like knocks it off the table, you know?
Yeah, it's wonderful too. I mean, it's also just interesting how people can draw, you know, materials from their dreams. I mean, in a sense, the dream is kind of the ongoing invitation and opportunity to perform precisely the sorts of expressive, creative projects that we have talked about earlier in this episode. It's there, once you start looping in dream or music or movement to your processing of your dream life, then of course the dreams themselves become more pliable. They're more interested suddenly. They're like, ah, you're paying attention. Well, here's some more material. How about this move? How about this? You know, so that those open, it's like there's an open loop where the universe, the subconscious rewards a kind of expressive verve, something bringing it back into the world, which whether we're talking dreams or psychedelic experiences, it takes the experiences themselves out of that kind of narcissistic internal space where I've just had my own precious moment that is unshareable, and instead impels a kind of sharing, a kind of collectivity, a kind of emergence into the world, which to my mind is a great expression of the kind of drives for integration. That seems like good work. And I also definitely want to fit in. We got about 10 minutes here. We have not mentioned Boyd Denison, perhaps the most unexpected creative arrow in your particular quiver. Who and why is Boyd Denison?
Well, Boyd Denison is he's kind of a Scottish character that he created. Sort of an alter ego. It's a way to explore myself better. It was a musical project that I started. a couple of years ago. I made a song for it, a sort of a Scottish necromantic rap song, and then I made a video for it as well. And then since then, it's kind of evolved, and this whole character has gained more body to it. So Void Denizen is a necromancer who, how shall I say, communicates with the other side through his boombox, through EVP, which is electronic voice phenomenon, a very interesting phenomenon with which to bridge worlds. Basically, you take a radio station and you tune it between frequencies to the sort of static white noise, and you take a tape recorder, or in this case an electronic recording device, and you basically press record on it, and then you call upon your dearly departed on the other side, whether that's your grandmother or John Lennon. Well, John Lennon, of course, is easier to communicate with through a radio. Then you ask questions to your dearly departed, and you leave spaces. And within those spaces, you start to hear sort of a signal in the noise. The white noise becomes shaped. Because, you know, when you don't have a body, you don't have vocal cords. So you got to give some kind of a chaotic material for the disincarnate entities to shape into something. And you start hearing shapes inside the sound, and then you might even hear words inside the shapes. And those words might actually correspond to the answers that you're looking for. So again, this is a sort of a sense of void and imagination, right? It's like you're delving into the chaos and you're pulling out the cosmic or the shape. It's sort of pareidolia or apophenia, this finding a signal in the pattern. So this is what this guy Void Denizen is doing. But at the same time, he's like the boombox is kind of outdated, so he's looking for something more modern. He's looking for the Philosopher's Stone. And to him, the Philosopher's Stone is a rock technology. For instance, your LCD screen on your computer is a liquid crystal display, which to him is like a crystal ball in a sense. So he's looking for something like that in order to communicate with the other side. And the musical video project becomes kind of an exploration of various rock technologies with rocks as a way to, you know, people talk about charging stones. I actually think that rocks are like sponges that can hold memories or become some kind of a container for time. Mm-hmm. And Void's whole idea is that all technology has at its root the goal of transcending space and time. And to him, that means communicating with the dead.
Yeah, that's good stuff. You know, it's funny, last week we were talking to Megan Prelinger on the show about the role of crystals in electronics, and particularly earlier in the 20th century when they really started to discover how much could be done with crystal lattices, and, you know, making the point that, you know, it's no accident that people think of crystals as being alive or as charged with energies, and because our technologies, in a way, manifest the same quote-unquote new age truth. But what I really like what you were just saying, again, is another model of creativity as kind of resulting from a kind of plunge into chaos, plunge into the void, where the forms that emerge from that process, whether or not they're coming from, you know, the astral realm of your own unconscious or your own biological capacity to weave pattern from noise, that it becomes sort of a way of both embracing chaos, which we all face in mm-hmm. various different ways, but also a way of really appreciating the stories, the patterns, the order that emerges from that experience. And by doing it as a practice, you know, again, we're coming back to this theme of practice, of expressive practice. By doing it as a practice, you're actually kind of manifest even a deeper philosophical relationship to these things as well. I mean, for you, what is the void? When we say the void, what does that mean?
Well, I guess you could describe it as anything that falls beyond the realms of language, anything that cannot be enforced by our tools. It's the thing that defies all description or the most ungraspable thing, the kind of the vibratory actuality, which to me, once we come face to face with this faceless void, we instantly start seeing faces in it. We instantly start magnetizing some kind of constellation in it. Even if that constellation is just a consolation for, you know, that we've inherited the emptiness. I think I have a good verse, a poetic verse from one of my songs, earlier songs, that kind of touches onto it, which is, "Give us language to express the timing of the endlessness. Give us language to impress our forms upon the emptiness. As interns of eternity, in turn we shall eternal be." So for me, the void is that emptiness that we get to shape through imagination, and then we get to release that again into the void. So it's ones and zeros.
And I wanted to ask one other thing also about you were talking earlier about the fact that you work in so many different media, and in my impression, and this is just an anecdotal impression, is that this is actually relatively common among younger people more of your generation than my generation. And it's just, and I don't, it's interesting to think about why that is. But it does seem to reflect a generational sensibility, in the sense that whether it's because it's so clear that no single medium is, you know, going to cut it because we're all so multimedia in our lives today, or whether it reflects a different sense of what it means to be relating to a medium, that maybe even the whole model of like, I'm going to, like, personally, I cut away a lot of the other things that I was doing, music to some degree, art to a very large degree, theater to an almost total degree, although I still perform when I give talks. But I really cut away a lot of stuff in order to kind of focus on writing, and then even increasingly nonfiction writing, which has got its own kind of complicated way of suppressing as well as drawing forward creativity. But maybe even that whole model of like, oh, I'm going to do this one thing and I got to be an expert at this one. I got to catch that rabbit is a little bit misplaced. And part of what the multimedia turn is also about is realizing that things can happen perhaps more spontaneously or unpredictably, or that have less to do with expertise and more to do with being in the right place at the right time. Does this make any sense?
For me, a few things came to mind. The first thing that comes to mind is a prism, right? When you cast the light through it, it'll sort of split it up into different colors. I kind of see it like that on the one hand, is that I myself, the medium of the self is the prism, and once the inspiration floods through, it sorts itself out in an array of colors or an array of expressions. On the other hand, I came to this country to be a filmmaker, and film is, of course, the ultimate crossroads of all these different disciplines. And then I took a long, let's say, psychedelic detour that, I'm self-educated. I basically learned everything, all my skills, I developed them through my own experimentation. And I took this detour where I went from writing to mostly painting, then still writing too, but the writing started becoming more poetic, and then the poetry started becoming more lyrical and more musical, and then music was born out of that. And then it's almost like this sort of tessellated Escher-like montage where they all kind of start to cross-reference each other in this synesthetic aesthetic, to the point where now I'm feeling like all my skills have been honed to the point that I'm ready to bring them all together, which the Void Denizen project, which is music and video and performance, is kind of a way to bring these together and like bridge my way towards that amalgamation of the cinematic medium. So for me, it isn't so much just like trying out all these different disciplines. It's my creation comes out of a sense of necessity. I feel it's almost like a necessary ritual collapse, like, oh, I'm charged with this thing. Will this block fit into this round hole of writing? No. Will this block fit into this square hole of music, or will it fit into this rectangular hole of performance? You know, whatever it may be, it's just kind of fitting, feeling where it naturally effortlessly and sometimes not so effortlessly will fit. You know?
And then how much does your being Dutch have to do with your creative path?
You know the Dutch, Eric. We're Renaissance men and where else?
And I say that only because, in my experience, one always has to step lightly in generalizing about nations. Sure. But there's a certain balance of practicality and wackiness in many of the Dutch people that I've met. Although I was not aware that you were Dutch when we first met because your English is so good. Once I figured it out, it kind of made sense in a way. Does it make sense to you?
It does. I think also the fact that I'm bilingual or multilingual is that it helps you kind of set aside the cultural interface and be able to go into that space beyond language maybe more easily or have more cross-reference between languages, which when I think about, I think we talked about this before at some point, but when people ask me, do you think in Dutch or do you think in English, I had to think about that for a while. And I think my thought ideally is actually a fleet of hypnagogic imagery. They're just fleets of imagery, and this imagery radiates language the way that a candle radiates light and heat. And most of the time, I might be blind to the image fleet, but I can still, I've atoned my sensitivity to the point that I can feel the radiance of language, so I can still speak the image fleet. And it's a cross-referential thing between English, Dutch, and whatever other fragments of languages I've absorbed. So in that sense, there's a constant cross-reference, cultural cross-reference between my origins and my current situation.
Well, wonderful. I think we're gonna have to leave it there. Michelangelo, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks. If anybody wants to check me out, it's voidandimagination.com. And stay tuned for more Void Denizen stuff coming out very soon.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's see, folks. Next week, what are we talking to? We're going to be talking about communes and collectives and polyamory. So join us on Expanding Mind. And remember, keep your minds open.